Hello and welcome back to the Electronic Intifada's live stream for Thursday, January 29th. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with my colleagues Ali Abunima, John Elmer, Asawin Stanley, and Tamara Nassar. It's day 846 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Coming up, Doctors Without Borders, one of the aid groups Israel is banning from Gaza, has said it will bow to Israeli demands that it hand over the names of its Palestinian employees. Dr. Hassan Abusitta, the Palestinian-British surgeon who spent 43 days saving lives in Gaza at the start of the genocide, joins us on today's program to explain why he is denouncing this move. Later on in the program, John will report on the role of the civil defense crews on the front lines in Gaza. And just a quick note, we won't have a regular show next Thursday, February 5th, but we'll be back on February 12th. And of course, all of our coverage will continue on electronicintifada.net. Let's take a look at the news. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. Heavy Israeli shelling and tank fire remain constant across Gaza. Sources with Al Jazeera reported that Israeli forces targeted areas east of Khan Yunis on Wednesday, and warplanes bombed empty homes east of the city of Deir el-Balah in areas controlled and occupied by the Israeli military. At least two explosions took place in the north of Gaza as the Israeli army carried out demolitions in Jabalia and shelled neighborhoods east of Gaza City. Journalist Mahmoud Abu Salama recorded footage of Israeli gunfire on Jabalia camp on Sunday. He captioned this video, quote, "Despite talk of ceasefire in Gaza, this is the daily life of the residents of Jabalia camp in northern Gaza."
ارجع يا جهاد
Israeli attacks killed three Palestinians and injured three others on Tuesday in Gaza City, according to the Anadolu news agency. Among those killed was a 17-year-old boy. Israeli soldiers shot and killed a Palestinian in Jabalia on Monday, and a man was wounded by Israeli fire east of Gaza City that same day, as the Israeli army continued extensive bulldozing operations in the Al-Sanafur area and around the Al-Barch cemetery. These operations included the desecration of graves under the pretext of searching for the body of the last remaining Israeli prisoner of war in the Gaza Strip, which was returned on Monday. The Israeli army announced a large-scale search operation inside the Gaza Strip for the missing soldier and began desecrating the cemetery in eastern Gaza City, exhuming graves and destroying remains. Reporter Mahmoud Ghazi recorded footage in the aftermath of the destruction of the cemetery on Tuesday. Local sources told the Wafa news agency that the area and its surroundings were subjected to heavy artillery shelling and intense gunfire from military vehicles, as well as sniper fire and quadcopter drones, resulting in fatalities and dozens of injuries. Euromed Human Rights Monitor said it had reviewed documented reports indicating that the Israeli army dug up nearly 200 graves in the cemetery. Over the past 2 years, the human rights group says, quote, "Israel has systematically destroyed cemeteries in the Gaza Strip, dug up and vandalized graves, tampered with bodies, and transferred dozens of remains." The Israeli army has destroyed 21 out of 60 cemeteries in the Gaza Strip over the past 2 years and has systematically vandalized cemeteries and exhumed graves in all areas where it conducted ground incursions, Euromed added. Quote, "These actions included bulldozing graves, extracting remains, and crushing them with military machinery, repeatedly causing the mixing, loss, and disappearance of remains, as well as damage to neighboring graves." At least two infants have died due to hypothermia this week as Israel's blockade on proper shelters and caravans remains in place. On Saturday, a three-month-old infant, Ali Abu Zor, died from extreme cold and was taken to Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital, according to the health ministry in Gaza. The ministry reported on Tuesday, January 27th, that another baby, a 12-day-old newborn named Haytham Abu Qas, also died at Al-Rantisi Hospital from hypothermia, bringing the total number of child deaths from the cold this winter season to at least 11. Turning to the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces killed two Palestinians this week in separate attacks. Qusay Maher Ismail Halaika, 28, was shot and killed near a checkpoint in Bethlehem. Wafa news agency said that Israeli soldiers shot him and then left him to bleed on the ground. That killing followed the execution of a 20-year-old Palestinian, Mohammed Rajeh Nasrallah, on Tuesday by Israeli forces during a military raid south of Al-Khalil. Nasrallah was shot in the abdomen, according to the health ministry. During the raid, another youth was shot and injured with live ammunition. Israeli forces shot and wounded a Palestinian teenager also on Tuesday in the Qalandia refugee camp and the adjacent town of Kufr Aqab, north of occupied Jerusalem. Wafa news agency said that the teenager was injured during the second consecutive day of Israeli aggressions inside the refugee camp and Kufr Aqab, including the carrying out of demolitions of dozens of buildings, facilities, and infrastructure under the pretext of security claims and lacking Israeli-issued permits. Approximately 40 separate structures have been demolished in the area since the raid began, as heavy military vehicles and bulldozers are working to impose what the Jerusalem governorate calls a buffer zone alongside Israel's wall in the West Bank. Also in East Jerusalem, Israeli police and intelligence forces raided and shut down a screening of the feature film Palestine 36 at the Yabus Cultural Center on January 22nd. The Yabus Center stated that a unit from the intelligence services stormed the venue during the screening and ordered organizers to stop the viewing without presenting a judicial warrant. They also arrested the projectionist. Palestine 36, directed by Anne-Marie Jasser and shortlisted for an Academy Award, is about the 1936 to 1939 Arab revolt against British colonial rule in Palestine and portrays the roots of the Palestinian liberation struggle. The Israelis said that the Yabus Center was screening a film, quote, promoting work by a terrorist organization. The center described the move as, quote, a direct assault on freedom of expression and cultural activity in the city, adding that it reflects escalating restrictions imposed by Israeli authorities on Palestinian cultural life in Jerusalem in violation of international laws and conventions. Meanwhile, Israeli settler violence continues to expand across the West Bank with the support and participation of Israeli army forces. The United Nations Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights stated this week that, quote, state-backed settler violence has become a key driver of forced displacement, chipping away at Palestinian presence in strategic locations. Such settler-driven displacement, particularly in Bedouin and herding communities, usually follows the same pattern. An illegal outpost is erected near or inside a herding community. Settlers restrict Palestinians' access to water and grazing space. Settlers repeatedly attack communities, destroy property, infrastructure, and livestock, and injure or kill residents, the UN office said. On January 27th, approximately 300 Israeli Jewish settlers attacked areas in Masafar Yatta, south of Al-Khalil, and injured Palestinians, torched homes and property, stole livestock, and blocked ambulances that arrived to evacuate the injured, the UN said. Wafa news agency reported that one of the injured, Samir Hamamda, said he was beaten by settlers when a mob descended on his house, pelting it with stones and pepper spraying inside, wounding his wife and children. The Palestine Red Crescent Society said it treated two patients in the village of Al-Fakit, including a young man with a head injury and a girl with a broken hand. Other residents in the Masafer Yatta area were also injured, including women and children, when the settlers smashed the windows of vehicles and homes. In Khirbet al-Halawa, several Palestinians were hurt by stones thrown by the settlers, who also stole 150 sheep from the area, Wafa reported. Mohammed Hureini, a resident of Masafer Yatta and the co-founder of the Youth of Samud project, filmed the attack on Tuesday. He said, quote, "Over the past 5 hours, settler militias carried out a brutal pogrom against my people in my village, Masafer Yatta. The violent settlers stormed homes, burned properties, destroyed vehicles, and stole livestock. Settlers did not stop there. Their violence brought numerous injuries among civilians. All of this happened in full view of the Israeli army and police, who stood by and did nothing. Not a single settler was arrested. On the contrary, Israeli settlers assaulted two Palestinian women, and the soldiers arrested them, the women. It is organized terror carried out and enabled by the military with total impunity."
Settlers set up fire in front of the houses of the Palestinians. On the other side, you can see settlers, soldiers, watching the pogrom that was happening here. We are trying now to turn off the fire. What is it?
On January 25th, Israeli settlers assaulted and injured Palestinian herders in the Rajum Ali area in the South Hebron Hills and ran over a 13-year-old Palestinian boy with a tractor, fracturing his leg. Israeli security forces were present during the attack, but fired tear gas and stun grenades toward the Palestinian residents, the United Nations said. On Monday, January 26th, following repeated attacks and threats by Israeli settlers, the remaining 100 residents of the Ras Ain al-Auja Bedouin community near Jericho were forced to leave the area, bringing the number of people displaced from that community this month to about 600, according to the UN's Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. The office said that, quote, "settlers had damaged or blocked herders' access to grazing areas around the community and prevented them from using the nearby spring, severely undermining their livelihoods. This comes on top of livestock theft and frequent attacks resulting in injuries and property damage." Since the beginning of January, the UN Human Rights Office, OCHA, has recorded the displacement of 688 Palestinians from 8 communities due to settler attacks, which is over 40% the number of displaced people in that category for the whole of 2025. It also comes on top of the displacement of another 130 Palestinians this month due to demolitions. OCHA is carrying out assessments and working with humanitarian partners to ensure people receive the support they need, OCHA said. Other settler attacks were recorded this past week in Jerusalem, the central and northern West Bank, the Jordan Valley, and the South Hebron Hills. The attacks resulted in extensive property damage, arson attacks, injuries, and forcible displacement of Palestinian families, primarily affecting Bedouin and herding households, according to the UN. We've published many features in the last week, but we wanted to highlight Trapped Between Two Different Worlds by Ahmed Abu Shawish, writing from Gaza. It's 9 p.m. Gaza time, Abu Shawish writes. Rain is pounding against the broken, nylon-covered windows of my family's home in Nuseirat, central Gaza, and the wind pushes through every small crack. I'm sitting at my desk, holding a cup of coffee, and thinking about my father. We had a routine before 2023 of late night conversation, coffee, and long walks. But tonight there will be no long walk, and our conversation is happening through a WhatsApp video call. When he calls, I can hear the rain twice, once from outside my window and once through his phone speakers from thousands of kilometers away in Italy. the same storm falling on two different worlds. My father, Dr. Mohammed Abu Shawish, was evacuated from Gaza to Italy in September 2025, leaving behind the six of us, including my mother and my four siblings. Tonight, through a screen, we try to recreate the comfort of our walks and late-night talks, but nothing feels the same. His face is lit by the warm, stable light of an apartment in Europe, mine by the dim yellow of a battery-powered lamp. My father and I share the same quiet nature. We don't complain easily, and we don't talk about our fears much. In September 2023, he was awarded a scholarship to continue his postdoctoral studies at the University of Milano Bicocca, with a departure date of October that year. He postponed his studies several times, despite the multiple calls from the Italian embassy urging him to evacuate. He chose to remain with us through those early months of devastation and displacement. He believed that the genocide would soon come to an end and that we would all be able to go to Italy. However, that hope slowly faded over time. After more than 700 days, we reached the painful conviction that the suffering might last indefinitely. My father called the embassy in September 2025, hoping that it might evacuate all of us. But later that month, on a Friday morning, an official at the embassy called back with a message, "You'll be evacuated on Monday." Before he could even ask about his family, the official added, "But unfortunately, alone." My father asked on the video call if I had started studying Italian. It wasn't the first time he had mentioned it. Ever since he reached Milan, he has encouraged me to learn the language, repeating, "You have to prepare yourself to come here." But I have not started to learn Italian. I can't quite believe I will ever go there. I nod and say, "Inshallah." This time, though, I laughed and told him that I barely have time for that. My days are consumed by my engineering courses at the Islamic University of Gaza, interrupted constantly by errands and lines to buy food and retrieve water. He stayed silent for a moment, then asked, "What are you waiting for?" "Maybe because I don't see the point," I said. "Why should I waste time preparing for a future that might never arrive?" He said I needed to get rid of these pessimistic thoughts. "You should learn Italian because it's the key to our reunification. Nothing else matters more." I didn't respond because I wasn't sure what the honest answer was. Instead, I stared at the blurry pixels of his face. I nodded and said, "Inshallah," even though we both knew it was less a promise and more a way to keep the door from closing completely. Those are excerpts from Trapped Between Two Different Worlds by Ahmad Abu Shawish, an engineering student, journalist, and activist based in Gaza, on electronicintifada.net. And now, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and resilience across Palestine and around the world. In Gaza, our recent guest, Maha Husseini, a researcher with the Euromed Human Rights Monitor, posted this photo on Wednesday of two young people painting a mural on a wall in Gaza City. Here's what Maha writes. Quote, "The University Square is one of Gaza City's most familiar landmarks. It holds the buildings of Gaza's two oldest universities, Al-Azhar University and the Islamic University, places that once pulsed with life. For years, this square was one of the city's busiest roads, shaped by the countless taxis and the daily footsteps of students arriving from every corner of the strip, carrying notebooks and doing last-minute revision for exams as they crossed the street. During the genocide in Gaza, this place was nearly destroyed. Some university buildings were bombed, while others were seized and converted into military bases by Israeli occupation forces. Roads were devastated, infrastructure damaged, and the square that once gathered knowledge was reduced to rubble. I loved this street. I knew it by heart. Here, I earned both my bachelor's and master's degrees. I remember its rain-soaked pavements, how the light reflected on the asphalt, how the city felt alive beneath my feet. This street also housed the media office where I found myself involuntarily becoming a journalist during Israel's 51-day offensive on Gaza in 2014, documenting a war while still learning how to name the world. I witnessed life and death here. I learned, I grew up, and I ran from airstrikes along the same road again and again. As fate would have it, my temporary office during the ongoing genocide now stands on this street. Every morning, I walk past my wounded university. I watch students crossing the devastated roads to reach their lectures, entering the same classrooms where I once studied languages, learning how to speak, how to testify, how to carry our story beyond these walls. Earlier this week, I passed by and saw a young woman and a young man painting a damaged wall of the university. They layered fresh colors over cracks and scorch marks, not to erase what happened, but to refuse its final word. In a place where the occupation tried to silence learning, these young people chose color once again. On a street devastated to crush life, students still arrive every morning. But most of all, I cherish this morning's painting because amid the ruins of a square that once taught me how to speak, life continues to insist on being heard. That's Maha Husseini writing from Gaza. And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You're watching the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with my colleague, Ali Abunima. Hi, Ali.
Hi, Nora. Thank you so much for that. It's so important to keep our eye on what's happening on the ground. And I just wanted to note that today, January 29th, is the second anniversary of Israel's murder of Little Hind Rajab, one of the most horrifying and documented incidents of murder during this genocide that still resonates with so many people. And the Hind Rajab Foundation put out a statement on that on the second anniversary of the killing of five-year-old Hind, we mark not only a moment of remembrance, but accountability. And they remind us that they are continuing to pursue justice for Hind Rajab. They have identified her alleged killers. You see some of them there on the screen, yeah. And they're continuing to pursue justice and accountability for her, as we must for all the victims of this genocide.
It's incredibly powerful. I not a day goes by when I don't remember what happened, and when I think about what Hind's mother and extended family have been through, it's unbearable. And that's just one of tens of thousands of children.
Just the children.
In the last, you know, what is it now, 26, 27 months. But, you know, justice is coming, and the Hind Rajab Foundation is making sure of that. On Tuesday, we had the chance to speak with Dr. Ghassan Abusitta. Do you want to talk about that interview, and then we'll go to that?
Yeah, of course, people will remember or recognize Dr. Ghassan Abusitta, a brilliant surgeon and a very outspoken advocate against the genocide and against medical complicity. I think it'll become clear in the interview. As you said, we recorded this on Tuesday to accommodate his very busy schedule, and we're so grateful that he could join us at all. And then afterwards, we'll have a couple of quick updates of developments since we spoke to him on Tuesday. So why don't we go to the interview?
Sounds good. Thanks.
Keeping and listening to the Electronic Intifada live stream, I'm here with my colleague, Nora Barrows-Friedman. Dr. Ghassan Abusitta is a British-Palestinian associate professor of surgery and a plastic and reconstructive surgeon with a long and distinguished international career. He spent 43 days serving in hospitals across Gaza at the start of the genocide, and since then has been advocating tirelessly for the people there. He's also the patron of the Ghassan Abusitta Children's Fund, which supports medical services in the occupied Palestinian territories and in Lebanon. We're honored now to be joined by Dr. Ghassan Abusitta. Welcome, Dr. Ghassan.
Thank you, and thank you for this invitation. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Dr. Ghassan. Last month, Israel announced an imminent ban from
working in Gaza on dozens of international organizations providing badly needed humanitarian and medical support to people there. They include Medical Aid for Palestinians, the American Friends Service Committee, World Vision, chapters of Oxfam, the Norwegian Refugee Council, and Doctors Without Borders, which is known by its French initials, MSF. Israel's pretext is that what they call terrorists could work under the cover of these groups, and it has demanded that groups hand over lists of their Palestinian employees if they are to be given permission to return. All the groups have refused to do so up to this point. MSF said last week that, quote, "We have so far refused to hand over this list as we are legitimately concerned about providing such information in a context where 1,700 humanitarian medical personnel have been killed, including 15 MSF workers since October 2023. But now the medical group has changed course. The statement says that MSF has now decided that, quote, "As an exceptional measure, we are prepared to share a defined list of Palestinian and international staff names in order to avoid being forced to suspend our operations in the occupied Palestinian territories from March 1, 2026. Dr. Hassan, over the last week, you have been extremely critical of MSF because it has decided to comply with the Israeli demand. Can you talk about why you're so critical and what you've been hearing from Palestinians who work with MSF in Gaza?
So the issue with regards to the request itself is that the request, as all dealings with the Israelis, starts with a request that the interrogator always makes for something that he already has. And so the Israelis would ask you for the list of your Palestinian employees. But once you acquiesce to this, once you agree to this, then there will be a next list of shortlisted candidates for jobs, and then a decision to ban certain candidates from jobs, and then a decision to ask for patients lists and patients information, and then a decision to decide which patients can be treated and which cannot. And so not only is the decision to send a genocidal power that has already killed 563 aid workers and 1,700 health workers, of whom 15 were MSF staff, wrong, immoral, dangerous, because it puts at risk the lives of these employees. It's also against European Union law that puts the duty of care on employers, on European employers, to not ensure the health and the well-being of their employees, and of European Union data protection law that prevents sharing of any data that would endanger the subjects in the database. And so, whatever you spin it, this is the wrong decision. Politically, this is a decision to accept the humanitarian sector's role in the new Gaza. Trump's plan for Gaza comes straight out of the colonial handbook. It is a Red Indian reservation, as envisaged after the genocide of the Native Americans in North America. And so the humanitarian sector, by agreeing to the conditions of the Israelis, will function as a prison canteen. What the Israelis want, and what we saw from Kushner's blueprint of Gaza, is that they are creating not an open prison as Gaza was before, but actually a modern prison where individuals are monitored and where prisoners, Palestinians, will have their canteen rations docked if they don't behave, by having them vetted out of receiving or working for the humanitarian sector. So this is the thin end of the wedge.
Dr. Ghassan, can you talk a little bit more about what would compel an organization like Doctors Without Borders to make this decision to comply with these colonial dictates. I mean, there's a level of condescension to these large international groups. And there is a distinction between charity and solidarity here. Can you talk about that and talk about what, you know, MSF, you know, Doctors Without Borders, being willing to throw their employees and their patients and their own legal obligations under the bus because they think their work is too important. This organization. Can you talk a little bit about that?
So we need to see the impasse that MSF is facing in the broader picture. It's obvious that Western imperialism no longer needs its liberal culture, liberal language, and liberal institutions to justify its imperialism. That jettisoning of everything from the Western humanitarian sector to International Criminal Court to the ICJ by Western imperialism is a rupture in the use of liberalism to justify imperialism as a reflection of cultural and political superiority of the West. And so these orphans of Western imperialism that have woken up to discover that daddy doesn't love them anymore, they have now accepted to change from the concept of liberalism in its many flaws to the new ideology of racialization, of non-grievability, and most importantly, to accept the idea that in this racial hierarchy, Palestinians inhabit a rung where they only have biological needs. They only need to be watered and fed and have no subjective dimensions to their existence. And so they're not a nation under a colonial occupation. They're not a people fighting for over 100 years for liberation and for emancipation. They're not people of color who are being racialized by Western colonialist system that has always racialized, brutalized, and exploited people of color in the colonies. So Palestinians now just need to be watered and fed for MSF. When you look back at why this was so easy for MSF, it's this idea of medical neutrality. It's as if medicine is a politically neutral sphere. It's as if the clinic, and with the clinic in the kind of Foucauldian sense of the clinic, is a place where power can exist in a vacuum, i.e., where in the clinical space, there isn't coloniality, there isn't colonialism, there isn't imperialism, there isn't racialization. And so that lie that MSF has lived to justify the unjustifiable, which is to look their patients in the eye and decide not to side with them against their oppressors, that has left MSF right open for that transition that it's making now from liberalism and liberal imperialism to racialized fascist imperialism that is based on good old-fashioned color.
Dr. Hassan, you wrote in a post a couple of days ago that MSF claims that Palestinian employees will need to sign a consent form for their data to be shared with Israel. Does you are a doctor and medicine, of course, is almost first and foremost about ethics before anything else. Does the concept of consent have any meaning in this context? And you've also cited some of the feedback from Palestinian employees. Can you talk a bit about what they are saying or what you're hearing from Palestinians in who work for MSF?
The idea that Palestinians in Gaza, having endured what they have endured, the killing, the slaughter, the destruction of all of their property, the intentional famine, the destruction of the social fabric of Palestinian society, with over 48,000 orphans, all of what we have witnessed since the 7th of October, the idea that those Palestinian employees of MSF, who I know are not just supporting their own families, but probably supporting extended families with that MSF salary, that somehow they have the ability to say yes or no to MSF. When we started getting testimonies from the employees, many of them said that there was a kangaroo consultation process that in itself was considered consent by the staff. But the idea that someone in Gaza who is now receiving a salary is able to consent or refuse and therefore face the consequences of the only part of the Palestinian labor market that is still functioning, which is humanitarian organizations, is absolutely ludicrous. It lies at the heart of MSF's neoliberal capitalist concept of free will.
Well, you mentioned the U.S. President Donald Trump's so-called Board of Peace a few minutes ago. And, you know, all of this is happening in the context where the U.S. is attempting to take direct control and ownership of Gaza. His son-in-law, Jared Kushner, last week unveiled a master plan to turn Gaza into dystopian real estate development with beach resorts and high-rises for an international elite, with Palestinians, at least those who are allowed to remain in Gaza, relegated to high-tech, biometrically controlled concentration camps. Kushner called it an investment opportunity, one that will undoubtedly be built over mass graves if it is built. And this week, DropSite reported on a leaked draft resolution, presumably to be passed by the so-called Board of Peace. And according to DropSite, the draft resolution, quote, details the structure of a U.S.-backed governing authority that would assume full legislative, executive, and judicial control over Gaza, including emergency powers, whatever that means. The stated goal of the Board of Peace is to transform Gaza into a de-radicalized and demilitarized terror-free zone that does not pose a threat to its neighbors. Dr. Ghassan, your reaction to these colonial proclamations and plans by the U.S. that has overseen and co-authored Israel's genocide?
And again, we need to kind of step back and look at this historically. Colonialism, and with it, its genocidal instinct, is a formative part of Western identity. And therefore, what we witnessed in the genocide, the main components of the genocide, famine, epidemics, slaughter, continuous geographical dislocation, are actually components of every Western genocide, from Ireland to India to Africa to South America to North America. What we understood from what happened in North America is then, once you're done with the major part of the killing, you create these reservations and you slowly wipe them out. And then, so what Jared Kushner is basically saying, like the native reservations, the United States, if you put a couple of casinos and you put a couple of areas where money can be made, then they have nothing to complain about. Jared Kushner and the logic of the Gaza board and the logic of the Gaza plan is a continuation. It's a structurally integral part of the genocidal project, the genocidal project as opposed to the genocidal war. The genocidal project includes a multitude of things, and one of them is Jared Kushner's plan.
Jared Kushner didn't use the word Palestinians even once in his presentation at Davos, which now, having listened to you speaking, I connect with this idea that Palestinians are just biological beasts who need to be fed and watered. They're not people with an identity. At the most, he referred to them as Gazans, which I think was a very deliberate way of erasing their identity, as well as significantly their connection to any other part of Palestine. How is that possible in 2026? I mean, on the one hand, it seems that there is more recognition and support for the Palestinian cause globally, more solidarity than ever, and yet the attempts at the destruction of the Palestinian people physically and even as an idea is also more intense than before. How do we, I mean, it's a very tough reality to live in. I just want to get, especially for us as Palestinians. So I just want to get your reaction to that.
So if we look back at what made this genocide different, it is the fact that it was from the very beginning the most articulated genocidal plan ever. And so, bizarrely, initially, we got one Israeli political leader after another, one Israeli military leader after another, one Israeli media pundit after another, and then Macron, Sunak, Starmer, all verbalizing the genocidal project in different forms. And then what we saw, in addition to the genocidal killing, is this performative violence of brutalization for 2 years. And one of the main reasons behind the performative nature of the genocidal killing was to create this rupture between the fact that we were in 2023 or 2024 or 2025, and the fact that we now find ourselves in 1800 logic, colonial logic, colonial language, colonial policies. That and the interesting thing when you link it with the colonial boomerang of what's happening in Minneapolis is it's that execution of American citizens, also in a performative way, is part of the necessary brutalism that needs to create rupture with the old language and the old system, which was hypocritical, but at least it never articulated itself in such a way. The brutalism and the performance of violence is a fast-forward mechanism to transition from one language and one logic to another, both serving Western imperialism in the shortest possible time.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that and those connections, the threat of imperialism from here in the belly of the beast of the United States to Palestine. Palestinians often observe that the technologies of colonial repression, first tested on them, are then expanded to other places in the world. Indeed, you know, Israel often sells its weapons and surveillance technologies as battle tested, meaning that they were developed against occupied Palestinians. Do you think the violence that the Trump administration is now unleashing in the streets of Minnesota and other states is a reflection of this? And do you see a connection between the street executions of American citizens like Renee Good and Alex Preddy which the government is openly justifying by demonizing the victims as domestic terrorists on the one hand, and what Israel has been doing to Palestinians on the other.
So Aimé Césaire's colonial boomerang explains how what Palestinians in the West Bank, in Gaza, in Lebanon, what Iraqis and Afghanis have gone through all of their lives is now happening on the streets of the United States. And what people of color in the United States had always gone through is now being exacted on white middle-class Americans. And so part of what we're witnessing is, in my opinion, a globalized reflection of white fragility. So white fragility in the United States, that these people of color are becoming more and more successful, they're becoming more and more integrated into society, just like the Tulsa massacres, always triggering these spasms of racialized hatred. And then in Palestine, white fragility, or globally, white fragility, white Western fragility, in the diminishing unipolarity of Western power, where growing regional powers are challenging American and Western hegemony, also is leading to this spasm of genocidal slaughter in order to try to at least cover the loss of power with an excess of violence.
Dr. Hassan, you are a surgeon with roots in Gaza and family in Gaza, and you spent the first 43 days of this genocide in Gaza trying to save lives. And you spend much of your time in Lebanon now, in Beirut, working with patients there, doing what you are trained to do and your mission in life, which is to heal people. You and I were both supposed to speak at a conference in Berlin in 2024, the Palestine Congress, where you were just going to talk about your experiences in Gaza, which were quite recent at that point. When you arrived at the airport in Berlin, you were detained. You were handed a legal order banning you from speaking in Germany. And then you were deported. The German police then raided the conference within an hour of its starting, and they shut it down. This was on a live stream. I was supposed to be speaking online, but nonetheless, the German authorities also banned me, and they issued a travel ban against me. They later issued another travel ban against you, and the same with me. And also they threatened me with prison and a fine, even if I spoke to a conference in Germany via the internet in July of 2024, which I did anyway. You waged a legal defense in Germany against this organized harassment by the German state, and in November you won. All of the measures that were taken against you by the German authorities to silence you were declared unlawful, and you won. But that wasn't all. The Zionist group UK Lawyers for Israel also filed a complaint against you in the General Medical Council in the UK, which could have resulted in disciplinary action against you, presumably even removing your medical license. And the complaint related to an article you wrote in the Lebanese newspaper Al-Akhbar, and two tweets which this Zionist group claimed impaired your fitness to practice medicine. Earlier this month, the General Medical Council's tribunal completely rejected that case and ended those proceedings. So another clear victory for you. So first of all, congratulations on those victories.
Thank you.
But I just want you to talk about this atmosphere of repression, which, you know, is affecting so many people. After that, then, of course, as many people know, I was arrested in Switzerland, and many people are arrested now just this week or last week in France. Amira Zaiter was sentenced to 15 months in prison for identifying a French-Israeli soldier who was with the Israeli army in Gaza during the genocide. 15 months in prison for her, no prison for the soldier who joined the genocidal army. And Omer Khaled is one of the prisoners for Palestine in the UK currently, as we speak, on a hunger strike and also refusing fluids. The Qodiya is a Palestinian woman in the United States who has been in ICE detention for 9 months or longer, in fact, since last March, almost a year, simply for participating in a protest against genocide at Columbia University. Can you make sense of this reality we're living in, where the people who speak against genocide, the doctors who treat children who have been wounded by the bombs dropped on them by the genocidal countries, are the ones who are being arrested, persecuted, deported, imprisoned, while the genocidaires fly around the world and receive red carpet welcomes? Did you ever imagine that is the world that we would be in 2026?
So the interesting thing about what we're witnessing is that this is all happening, this intentional silencing is happening at the same time as the Israeli politicians and leaders are openly verbalizing their genocidal intent, their genocidal plans, are performatively slaughtering people. And so there's a kind of almost a diametrically opposed direction. And the entertaining thing is that one of the jobs, the new jobs since the genocide of Western media, is not just to censor those against the genocide. It's to censor the Israelis from saying what they've been saying in their internal media and stopping that message getting to the rest of the world. And so you have a process where the aim isn't to suppress information, but to criminalize sectors of society. On one hand, you want to criminalize the colonial subjects who have moved from the colonies to the West and inform them that they still are colonial subjects, will be subjected to the same colonial violence, racialization, criminalization that they would have been subjected to had they stayed at home. Two, you want to create part of the rupture of that, that is happening, is to take back what we now realize was the largesse of Western capitalist power that was a result of the excess of power, i.e. liberalism, the notion of civil society, democratic freedoms, were, rather than inalienable rights, were part of the largesse of power because it never felt threatened. But now that the ruling elites in the West, global capital, feels threatened, it wants to claw back that margin that it had given you because it had felt comfortable giving you it, because now it doesn't feel safe enough giving you that freedom. So everything I mean, turning the General Medical Council into something that looks like Ba'athist doctor syndicate, so that it would police the political opinions of doctors and take their licenses away, or the way that the media has been expelling people for posts that they had in 2014, or, I mean, the list goes on. This is the rolling back of a margin that was rather than a reflection of a true belief in people's inalienable rights, democratic rights, was just a reflection of an excess of power that Western capitalism had.
And now they feel threatened, so they have to crack down. But,
and they have to take that margin away.
Yeah. So explore that, the fact that they feel threatened. What does that mean? Does that mean people have power? And, you know, maybe that's a positive, a silver lining to all this, that they're afraid of people's power. So what does our power look like, and what should we all be doing right now? Not that you have all the answers, but I know many of us want to hear your thoughts about how we should continue to be active. You have never shied away from the politics that is inherent in the medical field, as it is in every field. And also, I am throwing a lot of questions at you, but we've had many medical practitioners who are outraged by the genocide be very angry at organized medical doctors' organizations, the American Medical Association, others, similar organizations in Canada, I assume the same in the UK, that have remained silent. So talk about where our power is and just all those things I just threw at you.
Well, I mean, I think there are two things that are happening. I think the natural conclusion of the unhinged extraction of value from the world is that fewer and fewer people are becoming richer and richer. The middle class is shrinking everywhere, from the global north to the global south, where it's only middle class by the name of its profession rather than by its living conditions. The majority of the global south lives in a semi-proletarized condition, where all of the achievements of the anti-colonial era in terms of free education, free housing, and a welfare system have been completely rolled back. And so the conditions are almost pre-revolutionary, whether in the global south or in the global north. And so what we are witnessing at the moment is a preemptive attack that's aimed at increasing extraction from the global south. Because if you can see, one of the aims for global capital of the performative nature of the slaughter in Gaza during the genocide is that it takes Gaza and it shows it to the rest of the world to frighten everybody else into submission. You frighten the Colombians and you frighten the Brazilians and you frighten the Africans and the Asians into submission by virtue of what they've seen in Gaza. And so what you're witnessing is internally, there is a uncontrolled concentration of power, of wealth, that's leading to the average power in the whole system diminishing. And globally, that means that more and more of the world's population, particularly in the colonies, are becoming more and more less restless and challenging the authority of power, of the power of the empire. And that's why Gaza, rather than being an event, is a new historical phase where global capital will deal in pure violence, pure epistemic violence, pure ideological violence, pure physical violence against the Global South and against the people from the colonies inside the Global North and against populations within the Global North that may rise up against it.
Well, finally, Dr. Ghassan, you worked in Gaza, not just during this current genocide, but in many, many years past. What are some of the experiences that you still think about that keep you up at night? What is important for people to understand about the health catastrophe in Gaza right now, and how this has been completely engineered by Israel and the United States and the EU?
So the answer to the last part of the question is, I want to call on people to look at the lens through the lens of the idea of biosphere. So the biosphere is people's lived physical, biological, and social environment. What Israel has created in Gaza is a biosphere of genocide. So through the destruction of the physical, of hospitals, of people's homes, of water and sewage treatment infrastructure, of the social, and we've seen the destruction, the killing of 48,000. There are 6,000 who are the sole survivors of their family. There are 2,000 families that have disappeared. All of that social destruction. And then the biological, the famine, the epidemics, the destruction of health systems, the lack of shelter in the middle of winter. All of this biosphere of genocide is a machine that is capable of taking lives on its own without needing to be fed by the bombs and the missiles. And the only reason Israel acquiesced to the ceasefire is that it had put in place that biosphere that continues the genocidal project autonomously, only requiring to be sealed sufficiently so that it does not get altered in any way, so that you don't get a new sewage system in Gaza, or you don't get any health system in Gaza, or you don't get any building of the schools or the universities in Gaza. But on its own, as it stands, the genocide continues autonomously, because Israel fought two wars. One was the genocidal killing, but two was the genocide, the creation of a biosphere through selected and targeted destruction of the lived environment. The second one is with regards to one of the things that I came to realize at the beginning of the war, when Israel was trying to push the population initially just to the south. And when the first ceasefire happened and Rafah opened, I realized that the experience of becoming a refugee is such a formative part of post-1948 Palestinian identity, that becoming a refugee is a form of social death that is transmitted transgenerationally, i.e., that you die, and then you die again in Lebanon, and then you die again in Jordan, and then you die again in Iraq, and then you die again in Syria. And you never come back. There's no such thing as going out just for a week or so until you return. That experience of the social death of becoming a refugee is why the erasure part of the genocidal killing failed. The ethnic cleansing component that the genocidal killing was supposed to induce failed. And it was obvious to the very last minute when, despite everything, despite the fact that the tanks were rolling, 600,000 people remained in Gaza City in the last few weeks before the ceasefire.
And what just as a closing thought, Dr. Hassan, there's 2 million people in Gaza. As I'm sure you are, as many of us are, we're in contact with them every day. They're still living. There are babies being born in Gaza now. People that haven't given up on life and living. We haven't given up fighting for liberation, for justice, for is that what we do? Do we just keep going? Is that the way forward? I'm putting a lot on your shoulders, but
So it's funny you should ask this today. So today there's a database called PubMed, which is a database for medical research. And I came across a research paper from 96, an Israeli research paper, that found that 66% of Israelis are allergic to the pollen of olive trees. And for me, that is what got me through the day in having to spend the day writing and recalling some of these horrendous experiences, not just in this genocidal war, but in every war that I had been in Gaza from the 2009 to the 2012 and 14 and 21 and the marches of return and the second intifada, and even recalling my time as a medical student in Gaza, trying to work as a volunteer first aider. We will continue to fight for that land because we are an extension of that land. We are not allergic to it in the way the colonial settler is allergic to it. We are attuned to its every beating heart and its breath, and we will continue. We will continue. We will be here, kama baqiya al-za'tar wa al-zaytun, of which the colonial settler is allergic.
Thank you, Dr. Hassan Abou-Sitte. That's a beautiful way to end this really thought-provoking discussion. And on behalf of everyone who's watching and listening, let me thank you not just for the time you've given us today, but all you do to heal people physically and spiritually and to educate people. And we're so proud and honored to have had you on the Electronic Intifada live stream. And I hope we'll
thank
be able
so
to
much.
Talk to you again.
Yes. Thank you so much, Dr. Hassan. Wow. I mean, watching that again, I learned even more than than
I always hear, you know.
Yeah.
When we're sitting here talking to people live or recording in interviews we did, you're sort of thinking, what's the next question? Mm-hmm. You're looking things up. I always learn more when I listen again, and I always do listen again. Yeah. Just absolutely extraordinarily thoughtful. And we wanted to just give a couple of updates on the Doctors Without Borders, MSF issue that Dr. Hassan talked about. So since we had that discussion with him, we can see here that Al Jazeera is reporting that Oxfam, which is one of the major organizations, humanitarian organizations, also being kicked out of Gaza, is saying it is refusing to provide that information to Israel. It says, we will not transfer, Oxfam says, we will not transfer sensitive personal data to a party to the conflict, since this would breach humanitarian principles, duty of care, and data protection obligations. An Oxfam spokesperson told Al Jazeera, more than 500 humanitarian workers have been killed in Gaza. We call on the government of Israel to immediately halt deregistration proceedings and lift measures obstructing humanitarian assistance, the Oxfam spokesperson said. And also, the Palestinian non-governmental organizations network, PINGO, as it's called, condemned the decision of certain international organizations to bow to Israel's
pressure and share information on its Palestinian staff. Quote, the Palestinian Non-Governmental Organization Network expresses its strong disapproval of the actions of a limited number of international non-governmental organizations that have shared information relating to their local staff under pressure from the Israeli occupation as a condition for organizational registration. Pingo underscores the grave risks inherent in this measure, which constitutes a clear violation of the principles of international humanitarian law. So that, just a couple of updates on that.
And a couple of weeks ago, as we reported, the American Friends Service Committee also said that they would be refusing these Israeli conditions, putting their staff and their partners at risk. I guess we'll see. I know that there has been a lot of popular pressure on MSF, Doctors Without Borders. And I guess we'll see if that works or if MSF remains committed to its colonial.
Yeah, and of course we can't expect anything from the United States at the present time, but all the other Western governments more or less have condemned Israel's move and called on Israel to reverse this policy and allow these organizations to work in Gaza. Yeah. But, you know, all they're doing is issuing strongly worded letters while EU ambassadors brag about their new partnership projects with Israel. So it's just utterly cynical. They could force Israel to reverse this. They could do it.
They could force Israel to do anything that it is obliged to do, but they haven't.
Just today, the EU is bragging about new sanctions it's imposing on Iran, for heaven's sake.
Amazing. Amazing. It's just so depraved. All right. Well, let's bring on John to talk about some of the heroes. Hello. Oh, there you
hello.
Are.
You back.
Left and then you're back. Hello.
It was a great interview, guys. Yeah. Well done.
Thank you.
He's remarkable. And so you'll be talking about the Palestinian Civil Defense Rescue crews, the firefighters, the civil engineers, the people who are literally, you know, for the past 2 years have been rescuing people from underneath the rubble. Of course, Israel doesn't let any heavy machinery or construction tools in still. Another thing that the Europeans could force Israel to do today, but they won't.
But they don't.
Right. And so civil defense rescuers and engineers are using what they have at hand, literally, to rescue people and do their job. So take us through what you're going to be talking about.
Well, I mean, everything that we have done on this program for the 2+ years we've doing, civil defense is at the heart of it. The videos you show, the data we get, the footage of every massacre, they're there. Whether they have gas in their tanks or whether they're just using hand tools, they show up and they're on the front lines every single day. And they have been, not to preclude my talk, but they have been since Israel left Gaza. And so they just go, you know, Dr. Ghassan listed all the wars, you know, they're on the front lines of all of those wars as well. And the reconstruction afterwards, and just remarkable guys. And we mentioned them a lot and I promised that I would do a little package on them. So that's what I pulled together.
Wonderful. All right. Well, I'll do it this week. John, take it away.
Okay. All right. You are watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada. I am John Elmer. This is the Resistance Report for day 846 of Israel's genocide and day 112 of the fraud ceasefire, during which 492 Palestinians have been killed, 1,356 wounded in well over 1,300 violations. And civil defense teams have been able to recover 715 of the 10,000 bodies buried in the rubble. Just before we get to the civil defense, I just want to update that the last soldier, the body of the last Israeli that was in Gaza, was returned this week. Nora covered it in the news. This is the first time since 2014 that there are no Israelis inside of Gaza. Gaza. Israel Quds spokesperson Abu Hamza said, based on updated information that we have attained 3 weeks ago, we handed over to the mediators, the coordinates of the body of the prisoner, who was a police special forces officer. But the enemy deliberately stalled in the coordination and the search of the operations. And according to Shabak, Israel's internal security service, that led, along with the IDF, that led this operation, over the weekend, they launched the search of the cemetery where the police officer was buried. In the process of that, they exhumed 250 bodies and tested them, but they destroyed the graves and dug up the bodies of 700 people, Palestinians, in total from that cemetery in the Tufah neighborhood in eastern Gaza City. And these numbers are Israeli numbers. They wanted people to know how many bodies they dug up. They said they brought 20 dentists and dozens of doctors to identify the bodies. And they updated that number of the number of graves they robbed throughout the operation. Up to 700 is the last number that they have given. And even Israel, according to military sources, they believe that they think that Islamic Jihad didn't know that that was a soldier that they buried, that he was buried, that he was brought back during the battle of October 7th, and he was buried right away. And Islamic Jihad apparently didn't know he was a fighter, which explains the time it took, because as we know from this handover, the files of the prisoners were very much, the file was very much in hand. Qassam knew where to find people that were missing, even from other groups. But as we know, the last few were Islamic Jihad captures. Israel Quds captured those soldiers. So that is a mark to end the first stage of the ceasefire agreement. But of course, that ceasefire agreement is not worth the paper that it is printed on. So we will move on from there and get into the civil defense crews. We'll go to the first slide here. This is from before the war. We're looking at a photograph taken at a parade that marks and honors the civil defense teams once a year. So this was just a few months before October 7th. And this is a parade through Gaza City. And you can see there's only three fire trucks. They have a significant shortage of resources. And that is something that, of course, all of Gaza has had for the past two decades during the siege. The siege impacts the civil defense crews, the rescue crews. These are fire crews, medical crews, rescue crews. They do lots of training for the population. They are, for example, in these days of storms, they're going around and digging canals through the tent camps to move the water from the flooded tents, just really on the front lines in every single aspect of Palestinian society. But they don't have enough resources. They don't have enough trucks. Going into the war, didn't have enough trucks. And then Israel targets them as if they are legitimate targets, which we know this is the same as the medical and the education services. This is what part of the genocide was dismantling all of these civil society organizations that take care of the population. They were bombed, they were killed by tank shelling, they were fired on from drones, but there was also field executions. Their crew that were bound were found in Rafah last March, along with 15, total of 15 Red Crescent civil defense crews and an UNRWA official were killed and buried in shallow graves. The civil defense reports that 142 of their personnel, their pre-war number was 800 to 900 personnel, 142 of those personnel were killed in the line of duty, and additionally 352 staff members suffered severe or permanent injuries such as amputations, which have removed them from the service. So 50% of their personnel killed or severely wounded. They took on volunteers throughout the war, people joining. Civil defense is that they're currently operating at 5 to 7% of its pre-war capacity and has lost 85 to 90% of its heavy equipment and machinery. All 17 civil defense centers were completely destroyed during the war, and 61 of 72 vehicles. So total genocide aimed at the people who you saw on TV for the last 2 years, digging with their hands to rescue people from underneath the rubble. We'll take a look at the next slide here, because civil defense, they put out field reports and they put out field reports on their channel. And they this week's number was 348 missions that took place between Thursday, January the 8th and the following week. 14 firefighting missions, 169 rescue incidents, 91 ambulance missions, and 71 other missions. So what I've done here today is I've gone through about 7 months of civil defense field reports and selected some of the operations to show how critical these crews are. And of course, I could just show endless massacre scenes. But we'll try to keep that limited. But just remember that for the 70,000 plus people killed, at least, you had civil defense crews on the ground in virtually every single one of those situations, operating without vehicles, without proper tools. This first slide, number two, shows, I think, the scenes that we have come to know. These crew members rushing into the bombed out house. This one worker is pointing to the mattress. He's identified that there's a mattress there, and he's saying, be careful. This is the kind of work that they do. They know that there's a boy and a girl missing after this bombing. And so when they identify that mattress, they're careful in that area. And also at the same time, these crews are putting out the fire. They're the fire crews as well. So they immediately respond. And are the front lines of this battle in every way imaginable. And this video I cut, but they ended up pulling bodies from the rubble here. They talk about sometimes it takes them 12 hours, sometimes more, to get the bodies out of the rubble. And they're dealing with situations that are completely different than anywhere else in the world. In a recovery situation, you would have lighting all over it. You would have trucks, cranes, lifting people into different positions. You'd have different types of diggers that could gently move areas that require a soft touch, but also have heavy front end loaders that can deal with the heavy concrete to get it out of the way. And we could look at the next one. The next slide shows essentially what they've been doing since the war ended, which is dealing with all of the rubble all over Gaza. This is in the Nusrat camp from in early December, but this is a kind of footage that you're seeing that you'd see happening all over Gaza each day, cutting literally rebar piece by piece. And that rebar will be then taken out, extracted, restraightened, and used again. And the same with the concrete. They'll grind down, as they have in previous wars, grind down the concrete, turn it back into gravel, and use it again. And you can see they're using a front end loader here to get height. Just very, I think, resourceful is the word that you're going to be seeing in all of these slides. Constantly dealing with each and every piece of rubble throughout Gaza, because Gaza has been rebuilding for at least the last 115 days, but they were doing it during the war as well. But for the last 115 days, while the international community discusses what ways forward at the Civil Military Coordination Center in southern Israel, just a few miles from the Gaza border, inside, without AI, you know, dystopian drawings, you have people on the ground rebuilding their society day in and day out. We can maybe look at the next one, because knocking down these walls is a crucial part of it. Each individual one of these uprights is dangerous, and they have to be removed. And you see them here using the saws to cut broken extensions from the building, knocking out walls that are half destroyed, And these houses, if they're they're using bolt cutters here, handheld bolt cutters to cut the rebar. And if the houses are structurally in shape, people will immediately move back in and be living in these places. Life carries on. As Nora was reporting, people graduating, people still going to the university, still doing their master's work. You can see a guy on the ground here holding, they're holding a rope so that the piece falls off in a safe manner. They've been doing this. They have a lot of experience at this. 2 decades of all the wars in Gaza have given them experience in how to execute these operations. But really, we're watching... That was in Khan Yunis. We're watching them do it by hand. And this next one is really remarkable. This, I think, cuts right to the heart of the civil defense. Yeah, I mean, they're heroes in Gazan society. There's no question about it. We're looking at one of the civil defense workers here. He's been tied by a rope to the crane hook, and the crane hook is dangling him over to pull out the dangerous pieces on this building. And they do that by roping him up because their cherry pickers are destroyed. Their trucks with extended ladders are destroyed. And so they just did it directly by tying him to the crane. And there he is up, dropping all of these key pieces of destroyed material. There's a picture of him from a side angle that you can see him hanging on the crane. And the next one, we gave him a bit of a zoom in there that you can see him working on the edge of the crane. We watched him be tied at the beginning of that. And you can see him there working and see him there working again, dangling in the Gaza sky. So just remarkable work. And a lot of times that you see these, the people around, the kids are all around cheering them on, which is always a sign that you know they have a shine in society, is when the kids are all following their activities and cheering them on. So there's just a zoom in of that guy up on the top of the top of the building, lifted up through a crane hook. This next one has audio in it because I want to show you the way they use it. So they've got the sawzall there on the end of a whatever that was, 15-foot-long metal pole. They tie the trigger for the saw down, and then they use this extended pole. I think resourceful doesn't even really encapsulate how creative this work is and how effective they do it. And you can see they're using the human safety belt here, where one guy holds the other guy. Bolt cutters, again, just using primitive tools. The next one also shows, okay, here, let's watch it again, because this is just remarkable. Putting the saw on the end of that pole so that they can reach to grab that piece off that needs to be separated, knocking out these walls. The kids all cheer in the background on these, and you can see them there on the waterfront in Gaza taking down. You see the guy in the back is holding on to the guy holding the saw, the human safety belt. We'll see that in the next one as well. There were so many videos like this of them hanging off the sides of buildings, and you can see them use each other as their safety belt, lacking even the most basic materials, which Israel blocks. These are things that are all waiting on the other side of the border to come across, and Israel's blocked them all throughout the war. And see, there's the human safety belt. They hold each other while they're reaching out over the edge of the buildings. All of these things could have come in. They're all waiting at the border. They're all blocked by Israel all throughout the war. And a part of the fraudulent ceasefire that we're living through right now is that there's not enough fuel. And that fuel is necessary for these crews. It's necessary for the hospitals. It's necessary for opening the roads. The fuel is needed for every part of reconstruction, and that's why Israel blocks the fuel from coming in. And it has a devastating impact again. And we look at the next one. This is the very difficult part of their job that they have done. Number 10 here, digging up mass graves that Israel made all throughout Gaza, particularly in the hospital courtyards. And they go through them. They pull out each body. They bury them individually. They are the ones who take up the process of receiving the Israeli murdered, tortured, and dismembered Palestinians that have been returned to Gaza, and trying to link them up with their families is done by Civil Defense too. And as I said off the beginning of the show, they themselves have been put in mass graves in March 2025. Civil Defense themselves were buried by the Israelis in a mass grave. Headline from The Guardian: evidence of execution-style killings of Palestinian aid workers by Israeli forces. Doctors said forensic consultants say multiple bullets were fired from short range on bound rescue workers. The Euromed human rights organization said, following the total destruction of the workers' vehicles, the majority of the bodies were subsequently interred in a deep pit that was then filled with sand. These horrifying scenes serve as further evidence of Israel's ongoing genocide in Gaza as a major crime and a serious breach of international law. Of course, I think that goes without saying, but these guys handled the most difficult work. The next slide shows they're also firefighters. Which is a critical and something that's in a short supply now. We know that throughout the war, Israel targeted Civil Defense parking lots and destroyed all the heavy machinery in a single night, in some cases, of the entire station. So there's a real shortage of these fire hoses. This is in Barej camp in this was from last week. And they also do this. Number 12 we're on now is they do these first aid clinics, tutorials, where they go around and they show people. This is for teachers in schools, showing them how to deal with emergencies, how to set the bodies in proper position, and teaching people how to carry out the basic safety functions in their society. They go through the schools and do this. They train them in the schools. The head of the training department at one school emphasized the continuity of such courses and activities, which in turn enhance citizens' awareness. For her part, the school principal, Wafa Shabir, praised the constructive role of the Civil Defense in enhancing awareness among students and teaching staff, and commended the Civil Defense's significant efforts during the war. So the teachers saluting that work as well. And on the 2-year anniversary of the genocide, Civil Defense spokesman Mahmoud Basil gave a statement that I think really cuts to the core of the disposition of the Civil Defense crews. They said, after 2 years of continuous Israeli war on the Gaza Strip, we extend a salute of reverence and respect to our steadfast Palestinian people who face the machine of war and destruction with unyielding patience and unbreakable faith, despite the killing, despite the starvation and displacement and suffocating siege that has affected all aspects of life. We in the Civil Defense apparatus affirm our great pride in our heroic knights, who since the first hours of the war have been working day and night, facing the horrors of bombing and the fires of aggression, to save lives, to recover bodies, and to secure the lives of civilians, despite the lack of resources and severity of the dangers involved. We extend greetings and thanks and appreciation to all of our partners in the field, providers of humanitarian services in all sectors, who stood side by side with us and continued their work in the darkest circumstances in the most difficult moments. This war, which has affected every home and every family in the Gaza Strip, will not diminish our resolve, nor will it weaken our will to continue performing our humanitarian mission in loyalty to the blood of our martyrs and in loyalty to our people who deserve a dignified and who deserve a dignified life. Finally, we affirm that the civil defense will remain at the forefront of performing its humanitarian and national duty with full integrity, and its voice will remain speaking on behalf of the people of Gaza until this tragedy ends and peace is brought to all corners of our wounded homeland. That was Mahmoud Bassel on October 7th, 2025. So this has been the Resistance Report for day 846 of Israel's genocide in Gaza.
Wow. Thank you for that. I just, I mean, as you said, the resourcefulness of these workers, you know, using, I mean, just like, I was kind of like holding my breath with some of those videos. So
I wonder if there's someone on the ground, like, I just worry, like, is there someone on the ground level keeping people away, you know?
Yes, they are. They are. The kids all being cordoned around.
Good.
No, they're very safe and they know what they're doing and they know the way these houses are built. You know, a lot of these in the refugee camps are just cinder block houses with cinder blocks and rebar.
Yeah.
The floors are added, you know, when the family grows, they add another floor on top of it. And so these basic constructions, they know how to deal with them. And they just really are, you know, the best of the society, and
and they get no recognition, none.
No, like, there's no Netflix movie going to be made about them.
Yeah, I just kept thinking of all the propaganda around the white helmets, which you know was barely even a real civil defense group. It was an outfit created by James Le Mesurier, a British spook, for propaganda in order to propagandize people into supporting Western intervention in Syria. And in fact, they took part, you know, this is well documented now, although it's called a conspiracy theory by mainstream media, but it's incontrovertible. They actually took part in executions. They weren't saving lives. And yet they won an Oscar and I don't know what other awards. They were nominated for Nobel Peace Prize. Compare that with just the total disregard for these heroes, these real heroes.
Yeah. And I remember, I mean, you mentioned this, but I remember the systematic targeting of, you know, fire engines, ambulances, obviously.
And the front end loaders, they hit them all in Gaza City and right after the...
This systematically targeted humanitarian workers, civil defense workers, doctors, hospitals. I mean, that's what we were just talking about.
Every single aspect of life. Yeah.
With doctor... Yeah. We saw, you remember when we... Was he still in Gaza when Abu Bakr Abed took us on that tour? This was during the ceasefire in January of last year, a year ago. And he was able to walk across Gaza. And we watched those videos with him. I will never forget when he took us to the civil defense station and we saw all the fire engines, all the equipment bombed and strafed and machine gunned by the Israelis.
That's right.
You know, the water trucks
water trucks as well.
Yeah, the water trucks full of shell holes, so they can't be used.
Yeah.
Oh, well, thank you for that, John. I think we needed that, you know, the spiritual uplift there. now to bring it back down again, Ali, what can you tell us about this? Let's first go to the revelation, the acceptance by the Israeli army of what the Gaza Ministry of Health has been saying in terms of the official death toll, which, as we know, is a very conservative undercount. But what's significant about what happened today?
Yeah, so Haaretz, a well-known Israeli newspaper, reported today, and this, a lot of people are talking about this, the headline, IDF accepts Gaza Health Ministry death toll of over 71,000 Palestinians killed during the war. And it says the IDF has accepted the estimate of the Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry that approximately 71,000 Palestinians were killed during the Israel-Gaza war, noting that the number does not include missing residents who are potentially buried under the rubble. Now, notice that phrase that Haaretz used, Hamas-run health ministry. Now, we've been covering Israel's wars on Gaza for many years, since 2008, through the massive war in 2014, and then this genocide, which dwarfs all the horrific Israeli massacres before. And we never saw Western media, even Israeli media, using the term Hamas-run health ministry. This was introduced as a propaganda term during this genocide to cast doubt on these numbers that now even Israel is accepting. And as you said, Nora, almost everyone accepts that these are an undercount, because the health ministry in Gaza is very meticulous. They don't estimate, they only count bodies they've recovered. Mm-hmm. So this is a minimum number. It's absolutely the bare minimum. And as we know, we've seen estimates from various experts. There was that study published in paper published in The Lancet, the medical journal, some time ago, suggesting that the number could be in the hundreds of thousands. Yeah. And that's not unreasonable. So, but let's remember where the campaign to cast doubt on these numbers really took off. Of course, it was pushed by Israel and its lobby groups and PR firms, but it was certain officials who really pushed that right at the beginning of the genocide. So let's watch this first video of the top official who was doing that at the beginning of the genocide.
Quickly, in the 18 days since Hamas killed 1,400 Israelis, the Hamas-controlled Gaza Health Ministry says Israeli forces have killed over 6,000 Palestinians, including 2,700 children. You've previously asked Netanyahu to minimize civilian casualties. Do these numbers say to you that he is ignoring that message?
What they say to me is I have no notion that the Palestinians are telling the truth about how many people are killed. I'm sure innocent.
Yeah. So that was one example of U.S. President Joe Biden at the time directly contradicting and casting doubt on the numbers. And the reporter asked him that question is from PBS, which is supposedly the U.S. serious public media. And just listen to the propaganda phrasing she used. First of all, the claim that Hamas killed 1,400 people, which even at the time we knew was not the case, all those people were not killed by Hamas, and that number Israel later revised down. But that's just an aside. She used the term Hamas-run health ministry, mm-hmm. also the U.S. quality media. And then let's look at another clip. This is Joe Biden's, President Biden's White House spokesman, John Kirby, also October 2023 in the first weeks of the genocide.
The Gazan Ministry of Health is just a front for Hamas. It's run by Hamas, a terrorist organization. I've said it myself up here. We can't take anything coming out of Hamas, including the so-called Ministry of Health, at face value.
And secondly, the president's talking more.
I think it's important. You know, Trump, the things now with Donald Trump are so awful. It's easy to forget how culpable, complicit the Biden administration was, and why people were so revolted by them, and why they did not want to see them reelected, because this is what they were doing. That is what they were doing. And just as another footnote here, John Kirby was rewarded for lying and inciting genocide recently, just a few months ago, with this plum job at the University of Chicago. So you can see America's elite universities, which punish and crush and expel faculty and students
who speak out against genocide or simply do scholarly research that Israel doesn't like. And genocidaire, people who are directly involved in a genocide with blood on their hands, like Admiral John Kirby, are rewarded and given high-paying jobs there. Absolutely corrupt and disgusting, and shows what a sick, sick society the West has become. And just finally on this, I want to point to what Dr. Hassan Abu Sitte said about this. Of course, we spoke to him earlier, but this news broke today. And his comment was, for every Western journalist who called me in the middle of the war when I was still in Gaza to cast doubt over the Palestinian death toll numbers, their blood is also on your hands as much as the soldiers and pilots. I hope that what happened to these victims and their families haunts you until justice is served on you and your accomplices. I don't think I could put it better than that.
Yeah. Very well said.
It was just endemic as well, this questioning of the health ministry, the Gaza health ministry, you know, in the Western media.
And it came from Israel. It came from Israel. It was an Israeli directive.
Excuse me.
Yeah, John Kirby wore dog tags. He was given dog tags by a soldier that was captured on the border from a tank. And he wore the dog tags for the whole time that he was speaking from the podium, speaking for the United States White House, wearing Israeli dog tags.
It was just on every news report, you know. I following the British media, as you know, as I did, unfortunately, to a degree, you know, you can't avert your eyes from it sometimes. It just seemed to be on every news report. They would say, well, you know, Israel disputes that, and they say it's the Hamas run health ministry, and the BBC was called into question because of it, and was accused by the Israelis of being Hamas propaganda and so on and so forth. Whereas, as you said, Ali, we know, because we've covered the various wars since 2008 of the Electronic Intifada, we know that the health ministry was not Hamas. Not that it should matter. It doesn't matter. It wasn't Hamas.
And remember, Asa, at the beginning...
It wasn't even true.
And remember right at the beginning, when this trope, when this lie began to spread through the genocidal outlets like the BBC, how did the health ministry respond? They published a list of everyone who had been killed up to that point. It was already, you know, many, many thousands.
Yeah.
This was fairly early in the genocide. It was many, many thousands. And what did they do? They published the what we call the quadrilateral name of every person. So the first name, the father's name, the grandfather's name, and the family name, and the ID number of every person who was killed. And that
full
can't
detail.
Be faked, because the family names can't be faked. And more importantly, the ID numbers. Israel controls the population registry in Gaza. Israel is the one that issues and has those ID numbers. So Israel could have said, if this was all fake, they could have said, aha, this list, it's full of fake names and ID numbers. You never heard them say that, did you?
No.
Because they couldn't. They knew that every single name on that list was real.
And
that's been the case through every war.
And that fake figure of 1,400 Israelis killed on October the 7th, which the Israelis later revised down, you still do hear it sometimes. You still hear people say 1,400. The 1,200 figure is still not accurate, because they say, you know, it was Israelis murdered by Hamas, which is completely untrue, because the number of the dead includes Israelis who were killed by Israel as part of the Hannibal directive. But also the very fact that it's worth recalling why those figures were revised down. The 1,400, they revised it down by 200 because the Israelis determined that the 200 were actually bodies of Palestinian fighters that they killed and that they had counted as dead Israelis. Well, that shows you how inaccurate they were. You know, there was a complete lack of... There was a cover-up that happened on October the 7th.
They were dead Israelis. Yeah, I mean, we could go into this, but they thought they were Palestinians that Israel had killed. The Israelis thought these are Palestinians that
I'm sorry. They thought, let's leave it. We'll come back to it another day. It's an issue we've covered before. But you're right, Asa. The point I want to get to is that those Israeli numbers from the first day, from that were put out as talking points, are still repeated with no examination, no breakdown. How many were military? How many were actually Palestinian fighters? How many were killed by Israel itself? There's no discussion of that.
It's not questions. It's not interrogated. They don't ask for evidence. It's taken as an article of faith.
As always. All right. Thanks for that, Ali. And now, as we mentioned in the Ghassan interview, there's now new details that are emerging of the plan by the Israelis and the U.S. of a panopticon, a concentration camp in Rafah. What do we know about these new plans and the details, and how it's being received?
Yeah, we talked last week, of course, we talked about the big fanfare, the launch of the Board of Peace, and Jared Kushner's plan for Gaza. He showed his master plan map, and then those AI images of skyscrapers with gardens hanging off them, and luxury resorts along the beach. And as we said from the beginning, this is all a cover for genocide. And what DropSite News has revealed in the past couple of days confirms that. DropSite News obtained a leaked presentation that really shows what's at stake here. And so they report that the U.S. military-led grouping supporting the so-called stabilization efforts in Gaza has put forward plans for a housing block for Palestinians in Gaza in an area under full Israeli military control, according to materials circulated by the Civil Military Coordination Center, CMCC. The planned community, if developed, would contain and control its residents through biometric surveillance, checkpoints, monitoring of purchases, and educational programs promoting normalization with Israel. So what they're going to do is gather up survivors of the genocide and then brainwash and re-educate them to love the people who did this to them. This is like taking Holocaust survivors, putting them in a re-education camp and teaching them that Nazi Germany is good, actually, and you should love it. I mean, that's not hyperbolic. That's literally what it is.
And it's similar to the centuries of colonial, control on this continent and across other continents by Europeans, of these, like the residency schools in the U.S. and Canada.
Indigenous people and
kidnapped children and put them in these schools. Yeah.
In order for the explicit purpose of destroying their culture, which is a genocidal aim. It wasn't called genocide at the time, but that's what it was. And that's what they want to do here, if we read on. But I think it's you talked, Nora, last week. We discussed the raising of land near Rafah, which we suspected was for this, and that's exactly what it is. So the presentation at this CMCC, which is the U.S.-run military headquarters in Kiryat Gat, was about the Gaza First planned community that will house 25,000 Palestinian inmates, I think we have to call them. And DropSite reports Palestinians would have to pass through a checkpoint to access the zone. Residents will be able to enter and exit the neighborhood freely, subject to security checks to prevent the introduction of weapons and hostile elements. All entering residents will be registered with biometric documentation to enable identification for movement and civil services. The registry will be based on Palestinian ID numbers issued by the authorities in coordination with COGAT, that's the Israeli so-called civil administration. As I said just moments ago, Israel controls the IDs and the population registry. It goes on, the proposed residential zone is referred to in the CMCC presentation as the Emirati compound,
While it is unclear why the name was chosen, the Emirati Field Hospital, which is funded by the UAE, is nearby in Rafah. I think it is clear. I think that, you know, Jared Kushner was very clear that the UAE is up to its neck in this, and who else is going to fund this but the United Arab Emirates? And then just some of the details here are so horrifying, Nora, and this really invokes what you talked about, the residential schools. Part of the proposal regarding schooling in the planned residential zone seems aimed at promoting an Emirati-inspired re-education program. It states that temporary emergency studies can expedite a curriculum framework to resume classrooms. The curriculum will not be Hamas-based, but will follow, quote, culture of peace principles. In other words, to undertake and foster mutual understanding, respect, coexistence. In other words, normalization with Zionism, normalization with the killers. And then finally, just some of the grim detail here, to enforce the restrictive vision, which would corral selected Palestinians into a zone where Israel and outside forces have complete economic, social, and security control. A police force would be installed that would operate under an international security force. Now we know what the International Stabilization Force is for. It's to police and cage the inmates of the concentration camps. Quote, civil policing will operate on site to maintain public order operating under the ISF, the presentation states, referring to the International Stabilization Force that has yet to be formed but will be led by Major General Jasper Jeffries, the commander of U.S. Special Operations. The presentation adds security sector reform requires updated police and defense laws and so on, and measures to prevent radicalization. So again, it's about total control of the survivors. As Dr. Hassan Abusitte said, corralling the survivors of the genocide into Red Indian reservations. And I just want to point out that China got accused of genocide for allegedly putting Uyghur people in closed camps for re-education. That's the allegation. And that was called genocide. Israel isn't even being accused by world governments of genocide for doing actual genocide. China was accused of genocide for doing less than allegedly doing, less than this Rafah concentration camp. And finally, just before you all pitch in, let's look at this tweet from Asal Rad, who watches the media very closely. Observing how Reuters covered this, Israel plans large camp for Palestinians in southern Gaza. And Asal Rad writes, what kind of camp, Reuters? What kind of camp? In any other setting, they would call this a concentration camp. That's what it is.
I mean, where do we even begin with talking about this?
The education's not Hamas. The education's UNRWA, a Palestinian-led education system that is one of the highest, highest literacy rates, highest graduation rates.
And they've been trying to get rid of UNRWA.
This is the thing. The Zionist lie since the Oslo Accords, so for the last 30 plus years, is that the reason Palestinians are hostile to Israel is because textbooks in their classrooms say bad things about Israel. And this lie, of course, is meant to serve a purpose. It's to distract from the reality that the reason Palestinian children and youth and adults are hostile to Israel is because of what Israel does to them in every level, including regularly raiding their schools, bombing their schools, tear gassing and shooting students on their way to schools. What kind of textbooks are going to counteract that? So for decades, there have been foreign-funded studies by the State Department, by the Belgian government, by academics from all over the world to study the Palestinian curriculum under the lie, the Israeli lie, that it's filled with incitement and hate and anti-Semitism. And all of these studies have shown time and again that that's utter nonsense. It's the reality is what teaches Palestinians what Israel really is. But this lie is being carried into this dystopian, Orwellian horror movie reality now, where the survivors of the genocide are going to be taught to love the people who did this to them. What kind of sick, depraved minds come up with this? And let's remember that yesterday or the day before, the ambassador of the European Union in Tel Aviv went on Cannes, the Israeli state television, and said how the whole EU fully supports the Trump plan. Mm-hmm. The reason that the European countries, the ones that whine about human rights all the time, said they didn't join the Board of Peace was not because they fundamentally disagree with this. It was only because they think that it should be limited to Gaza, not to have any other global ambition. But none of them object to the substance of this. And the Arab regimes, the Arab vassals of the United States went on with this. They all went to Davos and clapped like seals on the stage with Donald Trump and Jared Kushner, and Indonesia and Pakistan and Turkey.
Yeah,
a whole lot of them. This is historic crimes.
Yeah.
People will look back in the future and say, how was this possible? As they're doing now, when they're still digging up the mass graves of Indigenous people in Canada, the mass graves of babies under residential schools in Canada that were put there by the Europeans who claimed they had come to civilize them. They're still digging up the mass graves. And I remember Justin Trudeau, Governor Trudeau, the former governor of Canada, wringing his hands and saying, oh, we've all learned the lessons. And here they are, Mark Carney. I haven't heard him object to this either, the new hero of the world order. Has Mark Carney objected to this? This is just something that, you know, it's a cliche, but if you had made this up a year ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, nobody would have believed it. Antonio Guterres, where is Antonio Guterres? The whole of the UN, except for the few special rapporteurs, people like Francesca Albanese, they're all going along. They're all saying, I leave UNRWA aside. UNRWA has stuck to its mission, stuck firmly to its principles. Here, but in general, the UN political leadership is going along with this continued genocide under the guise of peace.
A thing on, you mentioned Ali, the myth of Palestinian school books sort of teaching Palestinians to hate, and how, you know, Palestinian children are taught the reality by the Israelis, not by any kind of mythical brainwashing. Like, all of these things, this is a total projection, and it is actually Israeli school books that teach Israeli children to hate. Back in 2012, the Israeli scholar Nurit Peled El-Hanan wrote this book, Palestine in Israeli School Books, Ideology and Propaganda in Education, and she examined 17 Israeli textbooks. And this was, you know, this was quite a while ago now. This was nearly 15 years ago now. And she concluded that the book studied, quote, the book studied here harness the past to the benefit of the Israeli policy of expansion, whether they were published during leftist or right-wing education ministries. So, you know, those school books can, in a lot of ways, completely erase Palestinians from the map. And we've seen so many ways since then, the escalating ways that the Israeli educational and media system teaches Israeli children to hate Palestinians, including Israeli children. And we've seen that, you know, with so many despicable videos over the course of the genocide. You know, I think of the trend of Israeli TikTokers, including children mocking Palestinians starving and being killed. during the genocide, as well as the horrific video that we reported on from Israeli public television of Israeli school children singing about completely eradicating Gaza. And when we reported on it, it was deleted from our YouTube channel.
That's right. Well, we still have it somewhere. I think we
on X.
On X, yeah. But yeah, I mean, as you know, as the saying goes, every accusation is a confession. Mm-hmm. No one is scrutinizing Israeli textbooks. No one is asking themselves why Palestine, where Israelis learn to hate. No one's talking about re-education institutions for genocidal Israelis. Or disarming the perpetrators of a genocide. And this is all being foisted once again on indigenous Palestinians who have been slaughtered and are now facing this kind of just absolute dystopian nightmare. There's photographs and videos of the Israeli army, flattening all of these areas, especially in southern Gaza, supposedly in preparation for this kind of concentration camp, to which they're bringing, caravans and these like prefabricated structures. And of course, 2 kilometers away, in something like 970 separate displacement tent camps around Gaza right now, where there are hundreds of thousands of families trying to do whatever they can to keep themselves warm and dry during these winter months. And none of those caravans are reaching the people there. I mean, it is stunning, not shocking, not surprising, because this is what Israel and the U.S. have always done to indigenous people. But it is stunning the way that this is all just being perpetrated day after day after day. And the people in charge of a genocide, those who have co-authored a genocide and carried it out, just get to strut around and make these PowerPoint presentations and talk about re-educating the indigenous people who they've slaughtered. This is how it is. This is the world.
But remember, let's try and elevate the mood. Remember what Dr. Abu Sitte said. Palestinians are not, they're not giving up. People in Gaza are not giving up.
No.
They are, as John showed us, they're getting on with work.
Yeah.
This is what they're doing, and that's what we have to keep doing. There is so much going on in the world. There is fear now that the United States is going to start yet another war.
Right.
It's dizzying, to keep up with it. But we can't let attention drift away from Gaza. That's what we will do. We will stay here focused on Gaza, on Palestine, no matter what. If attention wanes among, other people in the world, we will keep the focus on here. And and we want to also focus, going forward, we talk about this, to focus also on the activism, on what people are doing. There's so much going on around the country and around the world, in communities, and that's something we really want to uplift, that this work goes on no matter what. And the sea change, the global shift that has happened during this genocide and the shift in American opinion among young people happened, yes, in the context of this genocide, but the ground for that was laid over many, many years by the work activists, independent media, and others have been doing all along. People found somewhere to go. If there wasn't independent media, if there weren't activist groups who had been focused on Gaza all these years, all these people whose eyes have been opened would not have found a place to go, would not have found information to educate them. So that's something I really want to stress. We have to keep going no matter what, even at the moments when it feels like there's reason for despair.
Yeah.
This is not the first time we've felt that, and we can't really afford it. We just have to keep building and going on and remembering that we are the majority. The people doing the repression, the people doing the censorship, they are the minority. We are the majority, and we have to keep growing it.
Yeah.
Beautifully said. Thank you, Ali. Okay, let's take a look at the website. There have been some incredible news and analysis posts. There's our colleague Dave Cronin's latest, Germany grovels to Trump. He's always nipping at the heels of the leaders of the European Union who spend their time groveling to Trump and groveling to Netanyahu and performing these various humiliation rituals. So please go and check that one out. Thank you to Dave. We also have some features. I read the one by Ahmed Abu Shawish, but there's also that one at the very top. The funding for Penn Pinter Prize is irredeemably tainted. Absolutely phenomenal reporting there. Ali, what have you been reading on EI this week? Oh, you're muted. You're muted, Ali.
the piece from Rada Hania, the feature there, really echoes in a way some of what you read in the piece from Ahmed Abu Shawish. Rada is a writer from Gaza, but she's currently in Malaysia, and so she's writing from her perspective about the, remembering being in Gaza, but also connecting with young, with family and loved ones there, and talking what it's like talking to them there now. So I think this, you know, it's a theme running in these pieces of separation and longing, and how Palestine, you know, that's been the Palestinian story for much too long. And here is a new generation who's experiencing that exile and that separation from loved ones, but utterly determined to keep that connection alive. So this piece by Rada Hania, I found it very moving.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Wonderful. Who do we have to thank this
season? And I just want to say one more thing. Yeah. You know, we're always telling people, you know, you can find us on Twitter, on Facebook, on YouTube, of course, on our website. You can also find us now on Upscrolled, which is the new app, which lots of people, more than 1 million people just in the last few days have come to, as TikTok becomes, as some people are saying, basically Israeli spyware on your phone. There's been this wave of people saying, you know, deleting it. I never had TikTok, so I didn't have that issue. But Upscrolled is actually a startup by a Palestinian Australian entrepreneur, and I've been on it. EI is on it. I hope it takes off, because we really need social media spaces where there is no censorship, where we can talk freely about these things and other things, and to have a space where we are not constantly having to fear being nuked by the censors. So find us on Upscrolled.
I think all four of us are on it, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Five, including tomorrow.
Yeah,
we are. We're all on there.
Come find us. All right, who do we have to thank this week, Ali?
Well, we have a lot of people to thank. We have to thank every single person who's watching and listening, whether you're watching live or whether you're watching this later, everyone who is reading the website, sharing the work we do, the work our writers in Gaza do. Thank you for doing that. Thank you for helping us keep educating people all over the world. And thanks to everyone who's given a donation to help us keep this work going. And I'm just going to say a few personal thank yous to Louise, Sam, Serge, Daniel, Brian, Ahmed, Ala, Max, Masami, Khaled, Therese, and Janet, and Christopher. You are stars for supporting us, and you are among many more people who have done so. And if you want to, you can go to electronicintifada.net and click donate now, or there are links in the YouTube description below. But only if you can. Otherwise, this work is free for everyone in the world. We want to share it as widely as possible. That's what we're here for. We'll never ask you to pay to read or watch or listen. This is for you.
Thank you. And again, we will not have a show next week, February 5th, but we will be back to regular programming on February 12th. And I just want to thank, of course, our producer and director extraordinaire, Tamara Nassar. Thank you, Tamara, for everything. Thank you to Ali Gerzon for social media production. Thanks to Pierre Loisel for radio production.
Can I reveal a little secret?
Yes,
sorry,
please,
to interrupt you, Nora.
Yes.
Next Thursday, I'll be in Galway, Ireland. And I'm just in Ireland for a couple of days, and I'm going to be appearing for a public event at the University of Galway. So search for the details. I don't have them at the top of my head. That'll be next Thursday. So I know we have many friends in Ireland, and if you're able to come, I'd love to meet you. So that's
fantastic.
You can catch me live there.
I wish we could all come join you. But soon, inshallah. All right. And thank you to everyone at the Electronic Intifada, of course. And on behalf of myself, Ali, John, Tamara, and Asa, thank you all. And we'll see you February 12th.